It's the Doctor Who edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we look at the influence Doctor Who has had on society. Let's begin episode 234.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. It is me, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Returning this week is one of our irregular regulars. It's host emeritus, Ethan Clow.
Hello, listeners. This is Ethan, your free-thinking Doctor Who historian.
Woohoo! So this week, I'd like to start off with a bit of a rant. There's just been a couple of by-elections that have happened, and one that was really close to home for me was in Brandon Souris, where it looked like people were finally starting to wake up to sort of what Harper's been kind of doing to his electorate. He sat in there was a nomination period where he kind of fiddled with it. There was like three people were going to run. Harper somehow stepped in there and essentially said, no, these two other people can't run. The guy I want to go in is going to be the unanimous voter. There's been all this stuff going on about the Senate, and the conservative parties have been running themselves on the idea we're accountable, we're responsible, we're respectful, we're nice people. But of course, what's coming out is there seems to be serious criminal charges coming out of the bribery charges from the PMO's office. And this was really making resonance in my home riding, which has been a solid conservative riding, sadly, since like forever. It has only gone to non-conservative once in the entire history of the riding. And that was a protest vote against the PCs when there was a big landslide and PCs were wiped off the map. It was so bad that the people who were nominated for the Conservative Party left the Conservative Party, ran for the Liberal nomination, and as it is, the Liberal nominee who's running is the son of the former Conservative member of Parliament that had been there again, I think, for like 20, 30 years. He was the member. But the election came down, and it looked like the Liberals were going to win. It was going to be tight, but they were going to win, and it was going to show Harper that he just can't smack around his own electorate. And feck, they still managed to win with all the jiggery pokery, with all the crap that's going on. It seems like democracy just doesn't work. Ethan, I know you don't know anything about this particular election because you weren't born in Brandon, were you?
No, I wasn't.
But is democracy dead? Should we start the revolution, grab the guns, head for the hills?
You know, I, the thing that I've noticed about politics, and I've noticed so much, is that despite scandals, despite feuds and schisms, people more often than not vote down party lines. And I think that we saw that even here in BC when we had our provincial election. I think that people, regardless of really what they say to their friends and neighbors, and they will vote down party lines. And I think there's even some science to back that up, that if you vote for one party three times or something, that's it. You're them now forever.
Well, that was the weird thing that came out about this, because our local newspaper, the Brandon Sun, was like staunchly conservative. But they were coming out with editorials and comments saying, hey, listen, you know, Harper, this is wrong. You can't do this. And they were running against it. It was like this really big groundswell. And I think an odd thing that happened, the Liberal Party in Manitoba, in Brandon in particular, was like the fourth party. I mean, it did really, really bad the last election, right? But they almost caught up. And the outcome from it, the voter turnout was like almost double what it was in other constituencies. It was 45%, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's still pretty crappy, but the one in Montreal was like 20%. The other ones were about 30%. So a lot of people came out for this vote, and perhaps they all came out for the Liberals, but it's just, there was just not enough new voters to do this. But alas, I will stop my rant there and go on to more happier news. This week, I thought we would take a look at Doctor Who, who's celebrating his 50th anniversary, and maybe some of the things that we can kind of learn from it. You know, maybe there's lessons in there that we didn't know we were learning, but we were learning. So, let's perhaps have a quick primer on Doctor Who for those who don't know who the Doctor is or what Doctor Who is all about. So, Ethan, can you give us a intensive, deep, analytical view of Doctor Who and his social political impacts on society?
You got 5 minutes, yeah, sure. Doctor Who is, I believe it is the longest-running science fiction TV show in the world and possibly one of the longest-running shows ever, if you, you know, discount, like, the Tonight Show or news.
One of the things about that is because it had the pause in the middle, it qualifies and doesn't qualify.
Yeah. Well, exactly, right? I mean, if you consider things like NBC's news that started, I don't know, when TV started, and some people consider radio an extension, so things like, what was it, Gunsmoke?
Yeah.
Started as a radio. Anyway, whatever. We don't count those. The main thing is that Doctor Who started in 1963 under the leadership of Canadian Sidney Newman, who was the head of the BBC.
Wow.
And one of the first female producers at the BBC. She was, let me just get her name right, Variety Lambert. And she sort of guided the early series. And it was billed as sort of a family-friendly TV show where kids would learn about history and science from a mysterious time-traveling alien. And it kind of still is?
Kind of.
50 years later?
The original Doctor Who does look like your sort of Boffin professor type, and that has changed dramatically over time.
Yeah, well, the first Doctor was kind of a bit of a menacing character. He was kind of mean. But he still is kind of mean sometimes. but he was sort of a, like, kind of like James Randi, actually.
Yeah, condescending was sometimes the word. It's like, if you have nothing important to say, just shut up.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And some people kind of miss that antagonistic Doctor. But over time, he mellowed and became more of your sort of lovable grandfather type character.
Well, to a certain degree. Actually, yeah. I'll let you finish before I jump in.
Well, and basically what happened is the show went on, and the first Doctor, William Hartnell, was too ill to continue, so they replaced him, regenerated. That became a term in the series.
Which was a brilliant way to continue the show without continuing the actor.
Yeah, it was a really good idea. I mean, you can think of all the shows like X-Files, Stargate, where a cast member leaves and it's just not the same. It's a brilliant concept. And it went on till about the late 80s when it was canceled. And there was a failed revival in the, I think, 90s.
Yeah.
Before the series was revitalized in 2005.
Actually, I was listening to a doco about about Doctor Who, and I think he's the eighth Doctor, and he says he gets to brag because he's both the longest and the shortest Doctor Who. Because he's the shortest because he was like one sort of season or episode. I thought it was a movie, actually.
Yeah, it was like a movie.
Yeah. But because there were no other Doctor Who's, he was the eighth Doctor until 2005 when they had the ninth Doctor, so technically he's also the longest-serving Doctor at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, I guess in an odd sort of way, that is true. And, you know, over the course of the series, you've had most of the actors have gone about 3 years, the exception being Jon Pertwee, who did 5, and, of course, Tom Baker, who did 7, which was sort of unprecedented. Even now, no one does 7 years of TV.
No, and I mean, for me, Tom Baker was Doctor Who when I was watching shows, so he's become the definitive Doctor Who for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the terminology and the way the show works comes from Tom Baker. And it's also the time Douglas Adams, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he was one of the head writers. So you got a lot of that same kind of silliness, but it was ludicrous, but it was great.
Well, that was one of the things, again, watching the documentary that I did, how the Doctor Who sort of started off as this sort of boffin, and then in sort of classic 70-ish kind of mode, he kind of became a James Bond kind of hero, and then he kind of came a bit, as you said, buffoonish, kind of cartoon, almost clownish. So the last real Doctor before the longest and the shortest one was referred to as being very clownish in his in his makeup. But, you know, did you know that the second and third season of Doctor Who was stuck on the planet? That his TARDIS was locked up and he wasn't a space traveling guy or Time Lord like he is in the other ones. He was just a smart guy trying to help out a world in need.
Yeah, it was actually a really interesting situation because that was also the first time Doctor Who was in color. And they pop him down on Earth. He's wearing this bright blue smoking jacket He's an expert in, what was it, Venetian karate, which is basically him shouting, hi, and throwing you over his shoulder.
Well, apparently he does. He did know martial arts.
Oh, that's well, why John Berkey was a big man. He was, I remember in one of the early episodes, he's wearing a short sleeve shirt, which I think is the first and probably only time the Doctor's ever worn. And he's got this big tattoo on his arm, and he's just, he was a big man.
And, but he dressed it like a dandy. He was very,
oh yeah,
very, you know, ladies man, very 70s.
Yeah, he had his companions were Joe Grant, the very short-skirted Joe Grant, and eventually Sarah Jane Smith, who is, I think, probably the fan-favorite companion of all time. But yeah, and he was like the Avengers. He was cruising around in fast cars and gadgets and political intrigue. It was really a different vibe to any other of the series.
I don't remember, and you've watched the whole series now, right?
Almost all of it, yeah.
Which ones have you missed?
I'm making my way through Peter Davison's Doctor, so I haven't watched Colin Baker or the two other Doctors who come after him yet. But I'm getting there. It's a lot of stuff.
Spoiler: I remember Colin Baker. His version of the Doctor was much more biting. You know, like hey, I'm not you. I'm a Time Lord, right? I have all this power. So if I seem a little short with you at times, I deserve it. You know, yeah. It's just like, you're not really that important to, which in a way I think was nice because Tom Baker and a lot of the other ones were, oh yeah, no, hey, you're so nice and all that. It's like, you've got the power, you know?
Well, it's an interesting thing too. I mean, I think the show benefits so much from the fact that his personality changes.
Yeah.
And, you know, to a certain extent that makes sense. If you have a different body, and people are reacting to you in a different way, you're seeing the world literally through different eyes. It makes sense.
Don't go there. We're going to talk about that later.
Okay.
So what else about the history of Doctor Who? Like you mentioned, there's the companions. What other elements do we need to know about the Doctor to really understand?
Well, I think the thing that I always found fascinating was that he's such an atypical hero. He very rarely uses guns. I mean, you can probably count how many times he's used a gun on your hand. He always tries to find sort of a non-violent solution to a problem, and he's sort of known for being like a pro-science humanist. He wants everyone to get along. He's curious about the world. He does what he does because he's bored and he wants to find excitement, as opposed to, you know, sort of the Han Solo or even the, you know, William Shatner idea of like a cowboy in space. He's not that at all.
That's one of the interesting things that comes out too. I was reading a web thingy. I don't know how to quote it. And they were talking about what if some superpowers were real? Mm-hmm. And one of they did was immortality. And they pointed out that, you know, at a certain point in your lifespan, right, that, you know, if you live 10, if you're like a kid that's like 3 or 4 years old, a week is like forever, right? And proportional to your life, it is. By the time you get up to 100, you know, a decade is like, what? 10 years passed already? I didn't even notice it. Mm-hmm. So what would it be? What's it like for someone like Doctor who sits there, you know, and he has these companions who all die? I mean, all his companions technically are dead by the time he's sort of regenerated. He's like 1,200 years old or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing that how does he, why does he care?
Well, it's an interesting question because in the early seasons, we never really saw that kind of drama. We never really saw the Doctor express emotion in that sense. I mean, every now and then. Since the revival of the show, it's been sort of one of the main themes is that the Doctor kind of runs away from these problems. You know, he doesn't like to see his companions get old. He doesn't. He is sort of separated from them, even the ones that, you know, he kind of has feelings for because he can't stand the idea of not growing old with them, that sort of thing. So it's an interesting concept. Like, he's kind of got the heart of a child in sort of this God's body, and it's really hard for him to, I think, interact with human beings. I think the part of the appeal is that he sort of has this kind of very innocent worldview that is sometimes kind of crushed by the realities of time.
Groovy. So we're going to go for a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back and talk about some things we might be able to learn from the Doctor.
Saturday, November 30th, it's Mint Records' ridiculously early Christmas party at the Ukrainian Hall, featuring Jay Arner, Tough Age, Nardwar and the Evaporators, Rennie Wilson, The Ramblin' Ambassadors, Fake Tears, Sean Morasic Lives, and more. Tickets available at Red Cat, Zulu, or on brownpapertickets.com.
And we're back. So let's begin with the Cybermen, or as the question that's going to come up with this one, that as we replace biological parts with, quote, better mechanical ones, at what point do we stop being humans? Now, for those people who don't know, the Cybermen were originally wholly organic species of humanoids originating on Earth's twin planet, Mondas. Of course, there are other origin stories, but we'll stick with that one, that began to implant more and more artificial parts into their body as a means of self-preservation. This led to the race becoming coldly logical and calculating, with every emotion all but deleted from their minds. Of course, the premise of the sort of evil of the Cybermen is that what makes us human is somehow intrinsic to our bodies, that if we replace our heart with a machine, we'll no longer have the ability to love, that somehow part of being human is not just the brain, but there's the brain, the body, or dare I say, the soul. Ethan, what do you know about the Cybermen?
Well, probably the second most popular villains in Doctor Who mythology. They're interesting because they've gone through so many different, as you mentioned, versions. The very early Cybermen were kind of like the Borg from Star Trek. They referred to everything plural. You know, it was all about removing emotions. And then sort of in the 70s, they kind of became sort of just like cyborgs of like RoboCop or something. They would say I instead of we, and they demonstrated emotion a little bit. And then in the revival, they went back to sort of the old-fashioned, you know, we are the Cybermen, you will be assimilated, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I mean, interesting concept because the Doctor has always sort of had a very... there's only a couple villains the Doctor like legitimately hates, you know, the Daleks being one, maybe the Master, but the Cybermen have always kind of occupied a almost middle ground. It's almost like he pities them more than he hates them, and that's sort of come out a couple times when he fights them.
Yes, like how does he fight them?
Well, there was the when they first reappeared, he basically defeated them by turning on all of their emotions, and so you have all these people who have been converted into Cybermen suddenly waking up and realizing I'm a thing inside a machine, and they all sort of exploded in horror.
That's actually another interesting... I don't know if it's a change, because again, I haven't... I never watched a lot of the early shows, and you might be able to correct me on this. But the new Cybermen recruit. So it's not so much that they are these people from this planet that have replaced all their body parts with other parts. It's that they want everyone else to replace their body parts with mechanical parts. Is that right?
Well, yeah, they're out there to assimilate and they call it upgrading, I think.
Yes.
You'll be upgraded, yes. Yes, and that's sort of what they do. I think that in the original Doctor Who episodes, they often took on the form of like trying to colonize worlds, trying to wipe out all life so that they could build factories or what have you there.
Well, you know, and that actually leads to sort of an interesting idea then, is that if you replace all your parts with mechanical parts, does it really matter what sort of was the originating biomaterial? So the fact that we're humans and they're Klingons, let's say, just to first word, sorry for mixing up my franchises here.
Yes.
I mean, if you ultimately are interconnected machines, then it really doesn't matter what the source origin is it?
Yeah, I think that actually they have mentioned that on the show where, as an adaption, the Cybermen start to cyberizing non-humans. Traditionally, they were always humans that were being turned into machines. I think that one of the recurring themes in Doctor Who, there's sort of this science run amok theme about unchecked power and hubris. And I think that the Cybermen really play into that. And that's one of the things that I think the old shows have an advantage, is that there was a lot of stuff going on. The Cold War, recovering from World War II, the new technology of computers and everything coming out. People were like afraid of it. They didn't know what was going to happen. Nowadays, we have like things like cell phones and Wi-Fi, which don't necessarily make the best dramatic context.
No. Well, actually, see, I agree with there's a scary... aspect to it, but I think also in the 70s and that, there was also a bit more, I don't know, hopefulness that technology might be able to save things as well. I mean, it was much more balanced than it would have been, let's say, 100 years ago, where science would cure everything. You know, in the 1880s and that sort of thing, science would cure all our problems. After the nuclear bomb, hey, it has its really dark sides. But now it is so innocuous with our society that technology isn't a thing. It is us. I mean, who doesn't have their cell phone on them right now, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we have become the Cybermen writ light, at least, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But what do you get on the take that as we replace more and more of our body parts, we become less and less human? I mean, at what point are you no longer a human?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, I think in the case of the Cybermen, they cut out emotion, so they can kill and maim whatever without feeling anything. They view it as a weakness. I think most people philosophically would say that our emotions give us the defining characteristics. I mean, some people would call that the soul.
Right.
I don't think we would. But, I mean, it definitely makes us a cut above. I mean, we some of us feel bad about eating animals. Mm-hmm. Some of us don't because we don't think animals really feel anything or have emotions. So, you know, I think for us, it's more about it's less to do with, I think, a technological fear. Because, I mean, you're right. We all have cell phones. We all have gadgets, tablets. Now there's watches. I mean, we seem to be very, very unafraid of it anymore. I think more what will frighten us is the sort of emotional aspect, losing our ability to control ourselves, losing our privacy with our own thoughts, that sort of thing.
Well, and I think another aspect of it, too, is that in the 70s, let's say, this was future tech.
Yeah.
There are things like the cochlear implant, which replaces essentially your ears. People who are born deaf can hear. That it's no longer quite sort of something in the future. It's like, it's shit. It's kind of happening now, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's another thought I was going to... Oh, yes, I remember. It's interesting, too, the parallels, because they're also sort of a hive mind, right? I mean, that's another important aspect of them. But in many ways, isn't that what we do to soldiers? I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, we try to eliminate their individuality so they can function well as a team. And we need to brainwash them that I know that used to be a person yesterday, but now he's the enemy and you have to kill him.
Yeah.
So maybe the Cybermen are also a metaphor for the military complex.
I think that's true because the doctor does have a pretty cantankerous relationship with the military. As we talked about, the third doctor, when he was working with the military, always would insult them and say, you know, try to think outside the box. I think that, you know, we can sort of look at the Cybermen in the same sort of way we would have with soldiers who, you know, go out there, kill their enemy, and that's, you know, they wipe their hands, they're done. Mm-hmm. I think there is sort of a cold element to that.
And speaking of cold elements, the next foe we'll discuss is the dialects. And the idea of the logic of being xenophobic. So I've got a clip here from the Doctor Who Monster Files that I will attempt to play. And it will give you an understanding of who the Daleks are and what they're all about. We might not go through it all, but we'll go through at least the intro bit of it.
There is one creature that is hated and feared throughout time and space. The most ruthless and terrible creatures in all creation. The Daleks. Grotesque mutations, the Daleks were born out of 1,000 years of war. The mutated remains of the once great Kaled race of the planet Skaro. The Dalek creature lives inside an armored casing. Part war machine, the Dalek casing is like a living battle tank, built out of polycarbide and Dalekanium. Its purpose is to exterminate. The Daleks hate all other life forms. Anything that isn't pure Dalek is their enemy. The Dalek creature inside the casing is housed in an environment chamber attached by clamps and connections that go directly into the flesh.
Is the sunlight that's all it wants?
It can hear and sense things. It might look unwieldy, but the Daleks have anti-gravitational technology to levitate and fly. So running upstairs won't help one bit.
So there we have the Daleks. So where does the Daleks fit into the pantheon of Doctor Who foes?
Well, I think it's actually Daleks. But,
oh, yeah, sorry.
But there's many acceptable pronunciations. Well, they first appeared in the second serial of Doctor Who. Back then, the show was broadcast in half-an-hour bits, you know, four or five episodes a serial. And the Daleks were created by Terry Nation, who is kind of well-known in British science fiction circles. He did a lot of one might call dark, disturbing science fiction serials, and the Daleks were sort of initially brought in as kind of the fallout of a nuclear war.
Okay.
Again, 1950s, right? And later on, they sort of took on more characteristics associated with, say, the Nazis, just in their sort of style. And I think the probably signature episode that the Daleks were in, which was written by Terry Nation, which went back to show their genesis, created by Davros, who was this extremely Nazi-looking alien creature. And it was quite a creepy serial in that the Doctor had an opportunity to destroy them, wipe them out completely, and unfortunately had an attack of his conscience and asked himself, do I have the right to genocide an entire species? And I guess, unfortunately for him, he decided that he didn't. And
yes.
Well, but I mean,
well, he did create a fan club that has followed him throughout space and time. I mean,
in many ways, they're almost more popular than the Doctor. I mean, when they first came out, there was toys, magazines, comic books. Terry Nation even just tried to get their own series at one point. They are probably one of the most recognized British icons in the world.
Yes, and who cannot forget the phrase, exterminate, exterminate.
Yes, which exactly.
I'm surprised it hasn't been done by a bug company. It has to have been done by a bug company. So we have the Daleks there. And on the one hand, you know, we can say that Daleks, you know, desire to exterminate all sentient life forms is a monstrous thing. I mean, you just said, hey, the Doctor really should have committed genocide. Really? You just went for genocide?
Well, I mean, and he says himself that there are planets, races who are at war who will become allies to fight the Daleks. There are consequences to them existing that will shape the rest of the universe. On the other hand, they're going to wipe out thousands of worlds, kill thousands of people, and even kill the Doctor occasionally. So you have to kind of wonder, how far will you go to destroy, you know, remorseless, unforgiving, murdering machine?
But can you really fault them in their logic? I mean, one of the things that's come out about this is that a number of scientists have been sort of calling for us to stop or halting our active search for extraterrestrial life under the banner of protecting our species. But, I mean, who'd want to kill us humans? We're nice people. We make good pets.
Yes.
By active, I mean like sending out signals actively saying, hey, hello, we're here. Why don't you come visit? Because the argument goes that most likely any life we encounter is going to be, at least in our current stage of development, is going to be vastly superior to ourselves. If we accept the idea that, you know, evolution is sort of survival of the fittest, or at least my species will more likely prosper with the removal of any non-relative competitor. So the aliens are most likely to have survived, those that are most likely to survive have removed any competition to their survival. So really, are the Daleks evil, or are they just sort of playing the evolutionary game? That if they are not xenophobic and they do not exterminate a competitor, won't in the long run a competing race eventually focus itself on the Daleks and exterminate them?
Well, interestingly, well, maybe. The one thing that was always, I found, bizarre about the Daleks was that the race that created them and the race that they were fighting, I forget what I think they were either, there's different word, there was the Dals and the Thals who were fighting on this planet. They had a nuclear war and the Daleks sort of emerged. But what was interesting though is that the Daleks were created by Davros, this sort of mad Nazi scientist, and they killed not just his enemies, they killed his own species. He had them wipe out everybody. And all that they sort of, the only emotion they have is hate, right? And so they honestly believe that they're sort of doing the universe a favor by just sort of wiping out anything that's not them. It sort of speaks to a different kind of survival. I don't know if there's anything in nature that even comes close to the way the Daleks view the rest of the universe. I think that they sort of have this sort of singular vision that a universe empty with just one Dalek is the best universe in the world. Like, it's the best possible thing if they could just have that.
Yeah. So first of all, I might point out maybe army ants are an example of life on Earth that sort of says, hey, if you're in my way, you're going to go. Mm. And one could also argue that humans kind of have that sort of attitude that, you know, I mean, we have in the past definitely gone out and actively both eliminated competition, as in Native Americans, yada, yada, and wildlife, if it's in our way, let's just get rid of it. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're not quite so different. But
well, I think that makes them scary. There's an aspect of the Daleks that we can see in ourselves, and I think that's what resonates with people. That and the fact that, you know, the Nazi connection, not to overdo it, but I mean, when the Daleks came out, we were only about 10, 15 years from World War II. It was still pretty fresh in people's minds, and I'm kind of amazed that that they were able to get away with it to some extent, because, you know, the other major event that happened right around the same time was the assassination of JFK. And, you know, the very next thing you're doing is this walking robot going exterminate, and it's, I don't know. I don't know if that would get away in today's day and age.
Are you implying that the Daleks killed JFK?
Well, somebody did.
Yeah, no, actually, and that brings up the other idea, because you're mentioning the Nazis. And one of the things that has haunted almost every society, maybe not so much in the 40s, less so in the 50s, more so in the 60s, and as we go on, is that we realize that the Germans were us. I mean, there was nothing special about them that made them monsters. And yet, for this one period of time, they were definitely monsters.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's, I think, all great science fiction has that sort of dark element of forcing us to look at the less savory sides of ourselves that we probably don't want to see. And I think that when Doctor Who does that, it can be very, you know, unnerving. I think that the Doctor himself has really sort of brought out some of these scary aspects about humanity and in some of the episodes. I mean, there's a great one, I think it's called Midnight, and it's almost like a play. It takes place in one setting. The Doctor is trapped on this, like, train going through a poisonous atmosphere, and something mysterious happens, and he's on a train with, like, six humans, and they all kind of go nuts. And it's realistically scary. Like, yeah. It's actually, like, I could see this happening on the SkyTrain going home, that we get stuck, someone, you know, goes a little crazy, and all of a sudden we have pitchforks and torches.
You take pitchforks onto the SkyTrain?
Well, sometimes.
Oh. We're going to go for another commercial break. When we come back, we'll take things in a similar but different, something a bit more nicer, but more revealing of our human soul. We'll be right back.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
And we're back. So the next topic, or next race we're going to cover, are the Ood, and the idea of collective consciousness and slavery. Now let's go back to, of course, the Doctor's Monster Files.
They came from a distant world. They voyaged across the stars. They sought to find humanity, and all with one purpose: to serve. Or so we're told. The Ood, inhabitants of the Ood sphere, the perfect servants. Or so Ood operations want us to think. Established in 3914, they've been selling Ood for over a century, supplying over 50% of Galactic Central.
Here at the Double O, that's Ood Operations, we like to think of the Ood as our trusted friend.
Be skeptical about their sales pitch. Be careful when you deal with an Ood. And above all, beware the red eye. They might be an alien race, but there are no communication problems with an Ood. They can talk to you in their native language using their translator spheres, with a whole range of optional voices.
How are you today, Ood?
I'm perfectly well, thank you.
Ood operations are proud to offer an Ood for every occasion. There are household, pilot, personal trainer, and, of course, military models. And since the Ood are mildly telepathic, they'll understand at once what you want. But there is a bit of a drawback. If you're using an Ood near a being with a powerful telepathic ability, like maybe an all-powerful demon from before the dawn of time or whatever, the Ood can be taken over by this mind control. If you see an Ood with red eyes, then red alert. Some handy tips.
We'll save the handy tips for later, because honestly, what is the likelihood that one of us is actually going to come across an Ood anytime soon?
Yeah, well, exactly.
One of the things that that helpful little informational thing didn't mention is the Ood are really unique in the Pantheon because they have two brains. They have a forebrain, which is in their head, and they have a secondary hindbrain, that has a sort of an umbilical cord structure that comes out of their face, and they actually literally hold it in their hand. I don't know why they didn't go with handbrain. I mean, it's so obvious. Their forebrain does much of their thinking and stores their telepathic sensors. The handbrain possesses memories and emotion, leading to, well, so that's where their emotions are stored. The Ood raised several interesting questions. First, we should deal with, as you heard in the clip, they're effective slaves, right? They make really nice servants. That makes me ask the question, well, if they're willing, if they truly do want to be servants, then is it really wrong to have them as sort of slaves? Ethan, what do you think? What are your thoughts about the Ood in general? And what do you think about this one question of someone willingly becoming a slave?
Yeah, it's interesting. The Ood were always sort of an odd alien, pardon the expression, they're a bit Ood, because on the one hand, they have this sort of passive, we just want to help you mentality, but then as we sort of later learn, it's not so passive, and they sort of have a few of their own motivations as well. I think it's also, there's kind of that element of a Trojan horse going through it, you know, like beware Ood's bearing gifts, because in the series, you know, we first meet them, they're almost sort of a sideline to the main story of their first episode. We later learn they're considerably more sophisticated, and they actually sort of have their own, a little self-serving views on the universe, and they also take a particular interest in the Doctor's lifespan. So, there's that whole element of, yeah, they may be your slave, but are they just watching you for any other reason?
Yeah, no, and actually another thing that didn't come out in the clip is that there is a Uber brain somewhere in the universe that is sort of telepathically linked to all the Ood in the world. And again, the whole, there's an idea there of collective mind. But you still haven't answered my question. So excluding the Ood, if the Ood were what we thought they were, mm-hmm. is it okay to make slaves of them?
Well, you know, my personal view on it is I don't think that we want to have anything that's really a slave that's, you know, sentient. I mean, if we had maybe Cybermen, that'd be okay. But it's the justification, you could say it's almost like utilitarian, that it's you're benefiting 90% of the population by disadvantaging the 10%. Why wouldn't you? It's a morality struggle, and again, like that's sort of what this kind of science fiction always does, is it makes you ask these uncomfortable questions about yourself, and you know, if really make you question what you actually believe.
And I think, and you see this in various episodes, and this is going to lead to my sort of next corollary, which kind of negates the premise of the first question, is so you know, they're not willing slaves. And as it turns out, that they actually sort of get lobotomized, where they have part of their brain taken out. And that makes them servile. Now, obviously, we wouldn't think that this was appropriate to lobotomize a human to make them sort of a servant. But what if they're not human? Would that really make a difference? I mean, we have this historical analogy that in the American chattel slavery, where people convinced themselves that African slaves were animals. They were equivalent to cattle. And therefore, what you did to them didn't matter. Analogies here?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's often this tendency to think of anything that's not quite human as wrong. Like, and if you think about it, if aliens did show up, they're not under the Geneva Convention. Like, you know, you could wipe them out, kill them, torture them, whatever. You're not really breaking any laws. And, you know, that does sort of raise an interesting question. As soon as we start meeting these aliens, you know, how are we going to establish universal sentient rights?
Well, and then that leads to the other question: at what point does sentience kick in? And at what point do we start granting them to, like right now, there's a big movement to give sentient rights to monkeys. You know, like it is in many areas now illegal to do any experiments on at least chimpanzees and those sort of higher forms of apes. And, you know, maybe this is a way to say, well, maybe we should take a better look around us when we start applying the idea of rights.
Yeah.
So another one that I want to cover these guys because they're so interesting, but frankly, I don't know how it fits in with our show. So I'm going to play the first bit that sort of explains who the Weeping Angels are.
Hmm.
So give me...
I'm not the only person who keeps a journal of impossible things. Not by a long chalk. Long ago, there was a man called Rastan Jovanich. He wrote down the most incredible things. Things that drove him mad. So mad that they sent him to the terrible insanatorium of Despard. And he disappeared. But his journal survived. And I've got it. It's barely readable, but it is the definitive work on the Lonely Assassins, better known to you maybe as the Weeping Angels. But of course, these statues aren't angels at all. They're not even stone. At least, not all the time. One touch from a Weeping Angel sends you into the past. They consume the energy of the life you might have led. They're called Weeping Angels because they cover their eyes as if they're crying. But they're not sad for the suffering they cause. They do it so they won't see each other. And that's because if someone's watching them, then they really are just statues. It's a defense mechanism. If anyone can see them, any sentient being at all, they become quantum locked. They become statues. But look away, just for an instant, and they can move. They can move so fast that they'll get you in the blink of an eye. The blink of an eye. The scary thing is, until they get you, you can never be sure that a Weeping Angel isn't just a statue. And you can't be sure that a statue isn't really a Weeping Angel.
And if that ain't a great point to stop on things, then why not? So I want to compile this with another race that's new to the Doctor Who universe. I have a clip for them, but I'm not going to play it because I want to hit on it quickly. And it's called the Silence. And the Silence are some sort of futuristic race that have come back to kill the Doctor for some reason that I don't think we ever do figure out. But they're kind of like the angels in the sense that whenever you're not looking at them, you don't know they exist. You forget everything about them. And I thought it was just an interesting entanglement of these two foes. And that, you know, there's... I don't know what it's about. I can't say it. There's quantumness in there, and there's the observation effect and that sort of thing. And it just seemed... they're too cool not to have left out. What do you think about the Weeping Angels / the Silence?
Well, the Weeping Angels are really interesting. They've become really popular since their initial creation. And the first appearance in the episode Blink is, I mean, a fantastic episode. The idea that that in the blink of an eye they can move across the room and nab you is just It's creepy. And the fact that they don't even really kill you, they just zap you back in time that you live to death, is also just kind of like, that's so Doctor Who. But yeah, I mean, they just sort of have a very... you know what it is, I think, is that as a kid, if you're walking through an old graveyard or something, that's the kind of thing that would scare you.
I was going to go even better. It's the monster under your bed.
Yeah.
As long as you're looking on a bed, there's no monster. But the minute you get up, you go, did I hear something?
It's just got that great culture to it, that this is the kind of thing that as a kid you're afraid of. And I think that's really what takes a lot of the Doctor Who villains into that next level.
Yeah, no, and actually production-wise, I think the Angels are done really, really well. I mean, you do get that sense of terror, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, you can't, it reminds me of Nightmare on Elm Street, where you can't fall asleep. It's like, you have to be looking everywhere all the time, and to do that. And what about the witness? The silence.
The silence, yes. Well, they're again, really, really new to the Doctor Who universe, and they have this ability that if you're not looking at them, you forget they're there. So if one's standing over your shoulder, unless you turn around and look at it, you will totally have forgotten it's standing right behind you.
Or if you sit there and you see them massacre an entire horde of people and destroy a building and who knows what, and then you turn away and you go, oh, I don't remember anything.
Yeah.
Because you forget that you've seen them as well, and that's the other weird thing. But, you know, Doctor Who is so full of contradictions in itself, and all of them are really focused on the Doctor. On the one hand, you have Doctors, you mentioned, he's the pacifist, right? He's mm-hmm. the thing. But as we learned in a number of episodes, he's also the destroyer of worlds. I mean, here's a person who is so powerful that he could wipe out races, the Daleks, you mentioned the whole, right? And yet, he hangs around with these puny little humans who at some point, they must sit there and they know that this person is so powerful that they are insignificant compared to him. And that must make you feel nervous in some level. I mean, what are the contradictions of the Doctor?
Well, as you mentioned, he's got this kind of dual nature of both being a hero, but also having the sort of wrath of God anger fits. I mean, we talked about him, you know, almost destroying the Daleks, and... you know, not to give any major spoilers away, the whole thing with the Time War and wiping out the Time Lords. And, you know, David Tennant, as the Tenth Doctor, had a pretty, you know, famous rationale, was that he gave you one chance. And if you didn't take that one chance, he'll kill you.
Yeah.
And he would not regret it too much. You know, so there is a hardness to him, a kind of... he's seen a lot, and I think that at certain points you kind of see this icy, godlike gaze. You know, I'm not going to put up with too much.
Yeah, and that's where I think, God, I can't remember his name now, but the colorful Doctor, I think this is the Sixth Doctor, the one who, remember I mentioned, said that...
Colin Baker,
yeah. I think that was kind of a preview of what the modern... I mean, I think the modern Doctors are based more upon him than any of the previous ones, in the sense that they have this sort of dual edgy, because the first generation of Doctors, the classic Doctor Who, was very much of kind of a nice guy, maybe a bit of a jerk sometimes, maybe a bit of arrogant, but he was just someone out trying to save the universe. Whereas in the second Doctor Who, and anyone who has not watched the latest series, what's the latest, the special is just on?
Oh, The Day of the Doctor.
Anyone who's not watched The Day of Doctor, turn off the radio for like 3 minutes. So one of the interesting things about that is in that, and I liked what they did, is they showed Doctor Who being responsible for the extinction, essentially, of his own race and the Daleks. And that the guilt over that event is what fuels him to be the nice guy, that he is trying to make up for past sins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the way that I characterize... Christopher Eccleston's reign, he was the Ninth Doctor, you know, he comes after the Time War, chronologically speaking, is he's a man with post-traumatic stress disorder. You look at the way he moves as a Doctor, the way he talks to people, he's very edgy. He goes from being like, just sort of sitting there, you know, oh, that's good, great job, Rose, to being like really animated, you know. And then you go to David Tennant, who is... has this amazing ability to make you cry by just staring at the camera. Like, and then you go to sort of Matt Smith, who's, you know, Matt Smith was never really my favorite Doctor, but he's got this kind of intense, like, you want to just kind of give him a hug, like, and just say, it's all right, you know? Like, he's got this kind of very almost guilty, childlike reality. And you can sort of see this progression of the Doctor getting over the Time War, getting over his crimes, right?
And I think it also plays into his relationship with his companions, right?
Mm-hmm.
In that, I mean, he knows that he's taking these people inadvertently, perhaps, but it's happened enough times that he should pretty much know that it's inevitable.
Yeah.
Into situations where they could lose their life, where they have lost their lives.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, we've seen, what is it, a couple of them anyhow. I know Rory died and his wife, Rose
no,
died. No, that's not her wife, but Rose also died.
Sort of.
Well, yeah, she yeah, okay. But the idea is, you know, it's the godlike thing, and every so often you see him sort of, you know, he's making his decision, and there's this like, I have to do this, even though I know I'm doing something that's kind of wrong. If I don't do this, then it'll be worse. You know?
Yeah, there's that. The Time Lords is interesting. His species are supposed to be sort of like guardians of the universe. They're supposed to watch over time and make sure things, you know, don't go screwy. And when he's the last of the Time Lords, it's on him. Like, you know, you can't say, oh, well, you know, my boss told me to do, you're just following orders. No, it's all on him. He's the only one who can bear this weight. And it's painful to watch. Like, it hurts to watch someone you care about do a horrible thing because there's no other choice. And I think that was really one of the interesting factors, especially with the modern era of Doctor Who. Prior to the revival, he was always running away from the Time Lords. He was shirking his responsibility. He ran away because he was bored.
Yep.
Now it's like, you've grown up, now you got to do the busy work, right? Like, it's intense.
Yep. So what other aspect of Doctor Who have we not covered that you think, hey, we've only got, like, you know, 7 minutes left. What do we have to cover before we leave Doctor Who?
Well, I think there is an interesting aspect to the Doctor that's come up recently. This is a meta category. The Doctor regenerates, right? There's been, I guess, 13, if we really are being honest. There's a couple things that we've noticed about every single one of them. They're all men.
Yes.
They're all white. And we know that the Doctor can change genders. He can change his shape. He's mentioned before how, you know, what if I come out with, you know, two heads or whatever. So a lot of fans, especially, you know, since the revival, when Christopher Eccleston regenerated, a lot of fans were saying, hey, you know, maybe he'll be a woman this time.
Yep.
And when David Tennant left, you know, a lot of talk was like, I think it's really going to happen. I think, you know, he's definitely going to be, you know, at least not a white guy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he was.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that I think we've learned a couple of years later that they actually offered the role to a black actor. I don't know his name. He was a British guy. Turned it down, apparently. But, you know, there's been a lot of, I think, a lot of, like, a legitimate desire to see the Doctor a different way.
And instead, they got the guy from the thick of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's tough because I think that when you take a character like that and switch him around so dramatically, you know, if the Doctor's a woman, it's hard for the writers to send him back in time. Because who's going to listen to a woman who shows up in a box?
Right.
If they make him black, I mean, you're opening the door for some really controversial and difficult decisions to make, sending this guy back in time.
Well, you see, and I think maybe to echo the disdain or the angst of people who'd like to see a more diverse Doctor Who, that is true if you limit him to Earth.
Yeah.
But if you make him go to alien cultures, I mean, you know, he can go to the island of Lesbos, or which has nothing to do with lesbians, but it's got that titillation, or the Amazonian planet or something. I mean, like there's no reason why he couldn't go back. And we've seen the Star Trek did that, right? Where
they
went to matriarchal controlled societies. So, I don't know, it seems like a bit of a cop-out. I mean, sure, maybe for a generation you're going to be a little more limited on women. But even then, there are ways around that sort of aspect.
Yeah, like, I'm not justifying. I'm saying that's how the writers probably look at it. And I think that there's a certain part of me that says, yeah, go for it, because that's going to challenge you and bring out interesting and dramatic stories. The other aspect is that, well, they also have a huge audiences of families and kids. And do we want, you know, the doctor fighting slavery? And do we, like, do we want that kind of show, right? And that's hard to say. Like,
he does fight slavery. We just talked to Ood.
Yeah. But again, separated by this sort of science fiction glass shield, right? So it's an interesting concept. I think that we will see a female doctor very soon. I think...
I think we'll see a doctor of color, whatever before, that might be, before we see him. Just because, one, as you point out, it does eliminate a lot of the preconditions that you can go anywhere in time, mm-hmm. and men are preferred just because of the male chauvinism through historical context.
Yeah.
And, okay, you may not be able to go to antebellum southern United States as a black person and hope to get any respect, but you could go to a lot of other areas. I mean, that sort of color racism is really limited to about 400 years in the middle, where we did have a slave trade. Before then, you might be a little out of place, but let's not forget, Shakespeare was talking with Othello, and one of the main characters of Othello, well, maybe it was even Othello himself, was a black guy, right? Yeah. So, I mean, like...
Oh, yeah, there are ways to avoid
And heaven
that.
Forbid we learn more about African history or Chinese history or Indian history.
Yeah, exactly. And let's face it, Doctor Who doesn't always have the best track record in portraying African or Asian history. There has been a couple episodes that, looking back on them now, kind of make you go, oh, that's racist. That's very racist.
the poor doctor.
Yes. Okay, well, what are we doing here, Don?
Oh, well, we're going to get ready to end the show, but I need to find my clip to end the show.
Okay.
So before I can do that, I'll do that there. Good. Hi, folks. So, Ethan.
How are you, folks?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I have tried so hard to learn the board. I am a good talker. And mechanical stuff, and anyone who knows me at work, I love computers, but I don't know, I just can't do both. I can't chew bubblegum and walk at the same time.
Maybe, that you should be upgraded, Don.
Ooh, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. So, any final thoughts on anything, Ethan? We got a minute or two to go.
Well, I have so many thoughts. Some of them are final. Well, I'll just say that it's great to be back on Radio Free Thinker. I'm glad to see you doing so many great stuff.
Yes.
So great episodes. I've been listening. And I intend to be back on radio very soon.
Ooh. I'm all Twitter. okay, so one last note. People who know me may have noticed that I have been a bit shaggier than usual. I am doing a sort of Movember sort of thing where I'm growing out my facial hair and my hair in my head is getting a little wild. Next Sunday at Best Buy, I am shaving top and bottom of my head. So to raise money for the United Way. So if you know me, you can drop off some money. If not, you can make your own donation to the United Way. Everything is appreciated. It's a good season to start thinking about giving to charities. We mentioned before, there's the Beyond Belief Foundation, which is a secular, sort of atheist-driven charity to give. Don't give to the Salvation Army or anything like that, not because they're evil people, but they're evil people, kind of. I mean, they mean well, but anyhow. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
This is Ethan, you're a free-thinking historian, saying thanks for joining us.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and, of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stars, but we are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.